These important teachings form the basis for the missionary aspect 32 of the Church's social doctrine, which is an essential element of evangelization 33. The Church's social doctrine proclaims and bears witness to faith. It is an instrument and an indispensable setting for formation in faith. 16. In Populorum Progressio, Paul VI taught that progress, in its origin and essence, is first and foremost a vocation. In the design of God, every man is called upon to develop and fulfill himself, for every life is a vocation. 34. This is what gives legitimacy to the Church's involvement in the whole question of development. If development were concerned with merely technical aspects of human life, and not with the meaning of man's pilgrimage through history in company with his fellow human beings, nor with identifying the goal of that journey, then the Church would not be entitled to speak on it. Paul 6, likely O 13 before him in Rerum Novarum 35, knew that he was carrying out a duty proper to his office by shedding the light of the gospel on the social questions of his time. 36. To regard development as a vocation is to recognize, on the one hand, that it derives from a transcendent call, and on the other hand, that it is incapable, on its own, of supplying its ultimate meaning. Not without reason the word vocation is also found in another passage of the encyclical, where we read, "There is no true humanism, but that which is open to the absolute, and is conscious of a vocation which gives human life its true meaning." 37. This vision of development is at the heart of Populorum Progressio, and it lies behind all Paul VI's reflections on freedom, on truth, and on charity and development. It is also the principal reason why that encyclical is still timely in our day. 17. A vocation is a call that requires a free and responsible answer. Integral human development presupposes the responsible freedom of the individual and of peoples. No structure can guarantee this development over and above human responsibility. The types of messianism which give promises but create illusions 38 always build their case on a denial of the transcendent dimension of development in the conviction that it lies entirely at their disposal. This false security becomes a weakness because it involves reducing man to subservience to a mere means for development, while the humility of those who accept a vocation is transformed into true autonomy because it sets them free. Paul 6 was in no doubt that obstacles and forms of conditioning hold up development, but he was also certain that each one remains, whatever be these influences affecting him, the principal agent of his own success or failure. 39. This freedom concerns the type of development we are considering, but it also affects situations of underdevelopment which are not due to chance or historical necessity, but are attributable to human responsibility. This is why the peoples in hunger are making a dramatic appeal to the peoples blessed with abundance for tea. This too is a vocation, a call addressed by free subjects to other free subjects in favor of an assumption of shared responsibility. Paul VI had a keen sense of the importance of economic structures and institutions, but he had an equally clear sense of their nature as instruments of human freedom. Only when it is free can development be integrally human, only in a climate of responsible freedom can it grow in a satisfactory manner. 18. Besides requiring freedom, integral human development, as a vocation also demands respect for its truth. The vocation to progress drives us to do more, know more, and have more in order to be more. 41. But herein lies the problem. What does it mean to be more? Paul 6 answers the question by indicating the essential quality of authentic development. It must be integral, that is, it has to promote the good of every man, and of the whole man. 42. Amid the various competing anthropological visions put forward in today's society, even more so than in Paul VI's time, the Christian vision has the particular characteristic of asserting and justifying the unconditional value of the human person and the meaning of his growth. The Christian vocation to development helps to promote the advancement of all men, and of the whole man. As Paul 6 wrote, "What we hold important is man, and each group of men, and we even include the whole of humanity." 43. In promoting development, the Christian faith does not rely on privilege or positions of power, nor even on the merits of Christians, even though these existed and continue to exist alongside their natural limitations. 44. But only on Christ, to whom every authentic vocation to integral human development must be directed. The gospel is fundamental for development, because in the gospel, Christ, in the very revelation of the mystery of the Father and of His love, fully reveals humanity to itself. 45. Taught by her Lord, the Church examines the signs of the times and interprets them, offering the world what she possesses as her characteristic attribute, a global vision of man and of the human race. 46. Precisely because God gives a resounding yes to man. 47. Man cannot fail to open himself to the divine vocation to pursue his own development. The truth of development consists in its completeness. If it does not involve the whole man and every man, it is not true development. This is the central message of Populorum Progressio, valid for today and for all time. Integral human development on the natural plane, as a response to a vocation from God the Creator. 48. Demand self-fulfillment in a transcendent humanism which gives to man his greatest possible perfection. This is the highest goal of personal development. 49. The Christian vocation to this development therefore applies to both the natural plane and the supernatural plane, which is why, when God is eclipsed, our ability to recognize the natural order, purpose, and the good begins to wane. 50. 19. Finally, the vision of development as a vocation brings with it the central place of charity within that development. Paul VI, in his encyclical letter Populorum Progressio, pointed out that the causes of underdevelopment are not primarily of the material order. He invited us to search for them in other dimensions of the human person. First of all, in the will, which often neglects the duties of solidarity. Secondly, in thinking, which does not always give proper direction to the will. Hence, in the pursuit of development, there is a need for the deep thought and reflection of wise men in search of a new humanism which will enable modern man to find himself anew. 51. But that is not all. Underdevelopment has an even more important cause than lack of deep thought. It is the lack of brotherhood among individuals and peoples. 52. Will it ever be possible to obtain this brotherhood by human effort alone? As society becomes ever more globalized, it makes us neighbors, but does not make us brothers. Reason, by itself, is capable of grasping the equality between men and of giving stability to their civic coexistence, but it cannot establish fraternity. This originates in a transcendent vocation from God the Father, who loved us first, teaching us through the Son what fraternal charity is. Paul VI, presenting the various levels in the process of human development, placed at the summit, after mentioning faith, unity in the charity of Christ, who calls us all to share as sons in the life of the living God, the Father of all. 53. 20. These perspectives, which Populorum Progressio opens up, remain fundamental for giving breathing space and direction to our commitment for the development of peoples. Moreover, Populorum Progressio repeatedly underlines the urgent need for reform. 54. And in the face of great problems of injustice in the development of peoples, it calls for courageous action to be taken without delay. This urgency is also a consequence of charity and truth. It is Christ's charity that drives us on, Caritas Christi Urget Nos. 2 Cor 5:14. The urgency is inscribed not only in things. It is not derived solely from the rapid succession of events and problems, but also from the very matter that is at stake, the establishment of authentic fraternity. The importance of this goal is such as to demand our openness to understand it in depth, and to mobilize ourselves at the level of the heart so as to ensure that current economic and social processes evolve towards fully human outcomes. Chapter 2. Human Development in Our Time. 21. Paul VI had an articulated vision of development. He understood the term to indicate the goal of rescuing peoples, first and foremost, from hunger, deprivation, endemic diseases, and illiteracy, From the economic point of view, this meant their active participation, on equal terms, in the international economic process. From the social point of view, it meant their evolution into educated societies marked by solidarity. From the political point of view, it meant the consolidation of democratic regimes capable of ensuring freedom and peace. After so many years, as we observe with concern the developments and perspectives of the succession of crises that afflict the world today, we ask to what extent Paul VI's expectations have been fulfilled by the model of development adopted in recent decades. We recognize, therefore, that the Church had good reason to be concerned about the capacity of a purely technological society to set realistic goals and to make good use of the instruments at its disposal. Profit is useful if it serves as a means towards an end that provides a sense both of how to produce it and how to make good use of it. Once profit becomes the exclusive goal, if it is produced by improper means and without the common good as its ultimate end, it risks destroying wealth and creating poverty. The economic development that Paul VI hoped to see was meant to produce real growth of benefit to everyone and genuinely sustainable. It is true that growth has taken place, and it continues to be a positive factor that has lifted billions of people out of misery. Recently, it has given many countries the possibility of becoming effective players in international politics. Yet it must be acknowledged that the same economic growth has been and continues to be weighed down by malfunctions and dramatic problems, highlighted even further by the current crisis. This presents us with choices that cannot be postponed concerning nothing less than the destiny of man, who, moreover, cannot prescind from his nature, the technical forces in play, the global interrelations, the damaging effects on the real economy of badly managed and largely speculative financial dealing, large-scale migration of peoples, often provoked by some particular circumstance, and then given insufficient attention, the unregulated exploitation of the Earth's resources. All this leads us today to reflect on the measures that would be necessary to provide a solution to problems that are not only new in comparison to those addressed by Pope Paul VI, but also, and above all, of decisive impact upon the present and future good of humanity. The different aspects of the crisis, its solutions, and any new development that the future may bring, are increasingly interconnected. They imply one another. They require new efforts of holistic understanding and a new humanistic synthesis. The complexity and gravity of the present economic situation rightly cause us concern, but we must adopt a realistic attitude as we take up with confidence and hope the new responsibilities to which we are called by the prospect of a world in need of profound cultural renewal, a world that needs to rediscover fundamental values on which to build a better future. The current crisis obliges us to replan our journey, to set ourselves new rules, and to discover new forms of commitment, to build on positive experiences, and to reject negative ones. The crisis thus becomes an opportunity for discernment, in which to shape a new vision for the future. In this spirit, with confidence rather than resignation, it is appropriate to address the difficulties of the present time. 22. Today the picture of development has many overlapping layers. The actors and the causes in both underdevelopment and development are manifold. The faults and the merits are differentiated. This fact should prompt us to liberate ourselves from ideologies which often oversimplify reality in artificial ways, and it should lead us to examine objectively the full human dimension of the problems. As John Paul II has already observed, the demarcation line between rich and poor countries is no longer as clear as it was at the time of Populorum Progressio 55. The world's wealth is growing in absolute terms, but inequalities are on the increase. In rich countries, new sectors of society are succumbing to poverty, and new forms of poverty are emerging. In poorer areas, some groups enjoy a sort of superdevelopment of a wasteful and consumerist kind, which forms an unacceptable contrast with the ongoing situations of dehumanizing deprivation. The scandal of glaring inequalities 56 continues. Corruption and illegality are unfortunately evident in the conduct of the economic and political class in rich countries, both old and new, as well as in poor ones. Among those who sometimes fail to respect the human rights of workers are large multinational companies as well as local producers. International aid has often been diverted from its proper ends through irresponsible actions both within the chain of donors and within that of the beneficiaries. Similarly, in the context of immaterial or cultural causes of development and underdevelopment, we find these same patterns of responsibility reproduced. On the part of rich countries, there is excessive zeal for protecting knowledge through an unduly rigid assertion of the right to intellectual property, especially in the field of healthcare. At the same time, in some poorer countries, cultural models and social norms of behavior persist which hinder the process of development. 23. Many areas of the globe today have evolved considerably, albeit in problematical and disparate ways, thereby taking their place among the great powers destined to play important roles in the future. Yet it should be stressed that progress of a merely economic and technological kind is insufficient. Development needs above all to be true and integral. The mere fact of emerging from economic backwardness, though positive in itself, does not resolve the complex issues of human advancement, neither for the countries that are spearheading such progress, nor for those that are already economically developed, nor even for those that are still poor, which can suffer not just through old forms of exploitation, but also from the negative consequences of a growth that is marked by irregularities and imbalances. After the collapse of the economic and political systems of the communist countries of Eastern Europe, and the end of the so-called opposing blocs, a complete re-examination of development was needed. Pope John Paul II called for it when in 1987 he pointed to the existence of these blocs as one of the principal causes of underdevelopment. 57. Inasmuch as politics withdrew resources from the economy and from the culture, and ideology inhibited freedom. Moreover, in 1991, after the events of 1989, he asked that, in view of the ending of the blocs, there should be a comprehensive new plan for development, not only in those countries, but also in the West, and in those parts of the world that were in the process of evolving. 58. This has been achieved only in part, and it is still a real duty that needs to be discharged, perhaps by means of the choices that are necessary to overcome current economic problems. 24. The world that Paul VI had before him, even though society had already evolved to such an extent that he could speak of social issues in global terms, was still far less integrated than today's world. Economic activity and the political process were both largely conducted within the same geographical area, and could therefore feed off one another. Production took place predominantly within national boundaries, and financial investments had somewhat limited circulation outside the country, so that the politics of many states could still determine the priorities of the economy, and to some degree govern its performance using the instruments at their disposal. Hence Populorum Progressio assigned a central, albeit not exclusive, role to public authorities. 59. In our own day, the state finds itself having to address the limitations to its sovereignty imposed by the new context of international trade and finance, which is characterized by increasing mobility both of financial capital and means of production, material and immaterial. This new context has altered the political power of states. Today, as we take to heart the lessons of the current economic crisis, which sees the state's public authorities directly involved in correcting errors and malfunctions, it seems more realistic to reevaluate their role and their powers, which need to be prudently reviewed and remodeled so as to enable them, perhaps through new forms of engagement, to address the challenges of today's world. Once the role of public authorities has been more clearly defined, one could foresee an increase in the new forms of political participation, nationally and internationally, that have come about through the activity of organizations operating in civil society. In this way, it is to be hoped that the citizens' interest and participation in the res publica will become more deeply rooted. 25. From the social point of view, systems of protection and welfare already present in many countries in Paul VI's day are finding it hard and could find it even harder in the future to pursue their goals of true social justice in today's profoundly changed environment. The global market has stimulated first and foremost, on the part of rich countries, a search for areas in which to outsource production at low cost with a view to reducing the prices of many goods, increasing purchasing power, and thus accelerating the rate of development in terms of greater availability of consumer goods for the domestic market. Consequently, the market has prompted new forms of competition between states as they seek to attract foreign businesses to set up production centers by means of a variety of instruments, including favorable fiscal regimes and deregulation of the labor market. These processes have led to a downsizing of social security systems, as the price to be paid for seeking greater competitive advantage in the global market, with consequent grave danger for the rights of workers, for fundamental human rights, and for the solidarity associated with the traditional forms of the social state. Systems of social security can lose the capacity to carry out their task, both in emerging countries and in those that were among the earliest to develop, as well as in poorer countries. Here, budgetary policies with cuts in social spending often made under pressure from international financial institutions can leave citizens powerless in the face of old and new risks. Such powerlessness is increased by the lack of effective protection on the part of workers' associations. Through the combination of social and economic change, trade union organizations experience greater difficulty in carrying out their task of representing the interests of workers, partly because governments, for reasons of economic utility, often limit the freedom or the negotiating capacity of labor unions. Hence, traditional networks of solidarity have more and more obstacles to overcome. The repeated calls issued within the Church's social doctrine, beginning with Rerum Novarum 60, for the promotion of workers' associations that can't defend their rights must therefore be honored today even more than in the past, as a prompt and far-sighted response to the urgent need for new forms of cooperation at the international level, as well as the local level. The mobility of labor, associated with the climate of deregulation, is an important phenomenon with certain positive aspects because it can stimulate wealth production and cultural exchange. Nevertheless, uncertainty over working conditions caused by mobility and deregulation, when it becomes endemic, tends to create new forms of psychological instability, giving rise to difficulty in forging coherent life plans, including that of marriage. This leads to situations of human decline, to say nothing of the waste of social resources. In comparison with the casualties of industrial society in the past, unemployment today provokes new forms of economic marginalization, and the current crisis can only make this situation worse. Being out of work or dependent on public or private assistance for a prolonged period undermines the freedom and creativity of the person and his family and social relationships, causing great psychological and spiritual suffering. I would like to remind everyone, especially governments engaged in boosting the world's economic and social assets, that the primary capital to be safeguarded and valued is man, the human person in his or her integrity. Man is the source, the focus, and the aim of all economic and social life. 61. 26. On the cultural plane, compared with Paul VI's day, the difference is even more marked. At that time, cultures were relatively well-defined and had greater opportunity to defend themselves against attempts to merge them into one. Today, the possibilities of interaction between cultures have increased significantly, giving rise to new openings for intercultural dialogue, a dialogue that, if it is to be effective, has to set out from a deep-seated knowledge of the specific identity of the various dialogue partners. Let it not be forgotten that the increased commercialization of cultural exchange today leads to a twofold danger. First, one may observe a cultural eclecticism that is often assumed uncritically. Cultures are simply placed alongside one another and viewed as substantially equivalent and interchangeable. This easily yields to a relativism that does not serve true intercultural dialogue on the social plane. Cultural relativism has the effect that cultural groups coexist side by side, but remain separate, with no authentic dialogue, and therefore with no true integration. Secondly, the opposite danger exists, that of cultural leveling, and indiscriminate acceptance of types of conduct and lifestyles. In this way, one loses sight of the profound significance of the culture of different nations, of the traditions of the various peoples by which the individual defines himself in relation to life's fundamental questions. 62. What eclecticism and cultural leveling have in common is the separation of culture from human nature. Thus, cultures can no longer define themselves within a nature that transcends them. 63. And man's up being reduced to a mere cultural statistic. When this happens, humanity runs new risks of enslavement and manipulation. 27. Life in many poor countries is still extremely insecure. As a consequence of food shortages, and the situation could become worse, hunger still reaps enormous numbers of victims among those who, like Lazarus, are not permitted to take their place at the rich man's table, contrary to the hopes expressed by Paul 6:64. Feed the hungry. Cf. Mount 25, 35, 37, 42. Is an ethical imperative for the universal church as she responds to the teachings of her founder, the Lord Jesus, concerning solidarity and the sharing of goods. Moreover, the elimination of world hunger has also, in the global era, become a requirement for safeguarding the peace and stability of the planet. Hunger is not so much dependent on lack of material things as on shortage of social resources, the most important of which are institutional. What is missing, in other words, is a network of economic institutions capable of guaranteeing regular access to sufficient food and water for nutritional needs, and also capable of addressing the primary needs and necessities ensuing from genuine food crises, whether due to natural causes or political irresponsibility, nationally and internationally. The problem of food insecurity needs to be addressed with a long-term perspective, eliminating the structural causes that give rise to it, and promoting the agricultural development of poorer countries. This can be done by investing in rural infrastructures, irrigation systems, transport, organization of markets, and in the development and dissemination of agricultural technology that can make the best use of the human, natural, and socio-economic resources that are more readily available at the local level, while guaranteeing their sustainability over the long term as well. All this needs to be accomplished with the involvement of local communities in choices and decisions that affect the use of agricultural land. In this perspective, it could be useful to consider the new possibilities that are opening up through proper use of traditional as well as innovative farming techniques, always assuming that these have been judged, after sufficient testing, to be appropriate, respectful of the environment, and attentive to the needs of the most deprived peoples. At the same time, the question of equitable agrarian reform in developing countries should not be ignored. The right to food, like the right to water, has an important place within the pursuit of other rights, beginning with the fundamental right to life. It is therefore necessary to cultivate a public conscience that considers food and access to water as universal rights of all human beings, without distinction or discrimination. 65. It is important, moreover, to emphasize that solidarity with poor countries in the process of development can point towards a solution of the current global crisis, as politicians and directors of international institutions have begun to sense in recent times, through support for economically poor countries by means of financial plans inspired by solidarity, so that these countries can take steps to satisfy their own citizens' demand for consumer goods and for development. Not only can true economic growth be generated, but a contribution can be made towards sustaining the productive capacities of rich countries that risk being compromised by the crisis. 28. One of the most striking aspects of development in the present day is the important question of respect for life, which cannot in any way be detached from questions concerning the development of peoples,